Welcome to the Whiskey Congress. Honest, open talk dedicated to speaking the truth to those who are open to hearing it. Black, white, right, left. Most importantly, honest, bold, and fueled by good whiskey. In Whiskey Veritas, we are Whiskey Congress. Join the evolution.
Welcome back to Whiskey Congress. We just finished wrapping up an episode with our friend Mike Wood Jr. out of Los Angeles, California, which we'll talk about quite a bit. But
California.
All right. So yeah, I was going Tupac on you.
I love it when you go.
So fun. But before we get into that, we do have a whiskey to review. We have a bourbon. I won't say bourbon finally because it was me that bought the other one, so it's because of me that we went Irish whiskey and then Scotch. But now we got a bourbon. We got Larceny Bourbon out of John L. Fitzgerald Distillery, or at least that's the name that's on the top of the bottle. Really good stuff. I like this.
So I'm a big fan of this, right? Like, you bought it.
What's funny? Then... I said, "Hey, Steve, I got a new bourbon for you." I'm like, "You've had that with me at my house, I'm
right?"
Like,
yeah.
Okay.
I bought this because I saw it and I was intrigued by the bottle. And a lot of buying whiskey, you don't know what's in the bottle.
You read the story.
Right? Like, I mean, you read the story. If you're familiar with distilleries, then you can kind of start to piece together what the flavor palette or what the flavor style might be like. But ultimately, you don't know what's in the bottle. And so you have to go off of, you know, kind of your optical senses, right? You look at it. Is the bottle appealing? Is the color appealing? What's the story? What are they telling me on the label? And so with Larceny, it's an interesting bottle. It looks kind of like a lock. There's a keyhole. It mentions the year 1870. And... So you look at it and say, all right, let's give it a shot. At the very least, I have a cool bottle to add to my collection. And if I'm lucky, then I have a good bourbon. And I think you really luck out with Larceny and the bourbon because it's got a quality flavor and it's got a quality delivery that says, you know what, I can do this multiple times over the course of a night. If this is my everyday sipper, that's no problem. So in terms of flavor, what are you getting? You're getting your oak barrel. You're getting the wood.
Very woody. Very woody. I like it.
It's not. Now, with bourbon, a lot of bourbons tend to be a little bit sweeter. And I don't get a lot of sweetness out of this.
I agree.
I don't get too much. I don't get too much vanilla. I don't get too much, there's been a shift as of late to kind of sort of incorporate honey into bourbons and American whiskeys, and I don't get that at all. This is definitely your more traditional whiskey. It's a little drier.
It's 92 proof, so it's
well,
definitely
it
got
is
some
92
punch.
Proof, and that to me matters a little bit because to pull for me, a lot of your better whiskeys, right? No matter what region, no matter what country it's coming from, continent. No matter where it's claiming from, a lot of your better whiskeys are going to be somewhere between your high 80s and your high 90s in terms of proof. Now, there are some that can get into the low hundreds, right?
Or like, mid-hundreds, like Booker's.
right. Like you've got Booker's, which is 150-plus proof. Blanton's is another one that's in the 150s in terms of proof. They can give you that high alcohol content and still give you good flavor where it doesn't burn your taste buds off.
Right.
You know, like, I mean, now it's still like, and Booker's is amazingly smooth, right? At 150 plus proof.
It's like 130, isn't it? I think it's more like 130.
I mean, we have a bottle right there.
There's the certificate on the front there. I think it's close to like.
Oh, no, you're right. Yeah. It's 128.1.
Okay.
And,
still,
and I just for some reason I feel like Blanton's is close to 150. But either way, but still, I mean, you're still in the 120
right.
plus
right.
proof of alcohol, whether it's Booker's or Blanton's, and you still have a good flavor. So Larceny comes in at 92 in terms of proof, and so you're still working with something that is, it's stronger than your average alcohol, your average spirit. And the flavor profile is distinguishable. Like you notice it right off the bat. Mm-hmm. For me, one of the things that stands out about it is that it's for bourbon, there's a dryness to it that is not too dry where you feel like you need to go guzzle a pint of water, but it stands out in that that's just the amount of dryness that I can appreciate in a bourbon, and yet you still get a little bit of sweetness to it as well.
I agree. No, I think it's a really nice bourbon. We've been ranking things. I'm going to go 8.
Yeah. You know, I can give you an 8 on this. I can agree with you and give you an 8 on this. And again, you have when you're tasting a whiskey, right? The first thing is, do you like it?
Right. There's that.
Like, let's start there. Because a lot of people will tell me, like, you know, I drink a lot of different.
So there's
whiskeys.
People will tell you Jack Daniels is the creme de la creme of whiskey.
Right, and, like, if you like it, great.
It's okay.
Right, if you like Jack Daniels, or you like Jim Beam, or you like whatever you like, that's fine. But like the first, for me, it's always do I like it, right? And if I like it, then we can at least start at a 5 or above,
right?
And so I like this whiskey a lot. I like, again, the flavor profile. Woody, dry, not too sweet. There's the one thing I will say, and maybe I think I'm going to knock it down to a 7 because you have the wood flavor. It's not too sweet. It is dry, but there's not a lot of distinguishable taste beyond that. And so there's plenty of bourbons out there that aren't too boutique-y. That aren't like we talked about Booker's, we talk about Blanton's. There's, you know, you can go Pappy, and you pick up different flavors in all of those. And this, I don't feel that there's a lot of diverse flavor in it. And so, because of that, I'm gonna knock it down from an 8, I'm gonna go to a 7 only because this is a good straight whiskey. It's got the volume, it's got the punch. In terms of alcohol content, it's got the flavor in terms of it carries the wood well, and it doesn't taste like a young whiskey. It tastes like something that's mature. And
agreed.
It
feels, very smooth.
It feels like something that they've worked out the kinks. So I feel very comfortable drinking it and extending it to other bourbon drinkers and everyone in the room saying, good bourbon, you know, everyone
right.
clink a glass. But you know, being if we want to fancy ourselves whiskey critics, then the one thing I will say is that there's not a lot of flavor that stands out, that dances on the tongue and says, ooh, here's this or here's that grabs me and I feel the need to articulate it.
All right. Well, I'm sticking with 8, but
no, that's fine.
They're both, both pretty complimentary ratings. We're also drinking a Victory Hop Devil IPA. It's an Eastern PA. I forget what town it's out of, and I could look at the bottle. I'd have to turn the bottle sideways, and I'd spill my beer. But,
Victory!
It's out in the Philadelphia area. Our Philadelphia listeners, will appreciate that we're drinking their local brew. This is a good beer, nice hops. It's
Downington?
Downington, Pennsylvania? Downington?
Maybe.
Okay. Because I could turn the bottle sideways to get the town right, but... it's a really good beer, smooth IPA, a lot of hops, but not so it's like painful to drink. In fact,
I don't do beer quotes or
yeah,
beer.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I'm a
Mr. Fancy
beer guy. Yes. All right, man. So after this, we'll get to hear us record.
Well,
with,
hold on. We did have our interview with Mike, and
no, we had just a discussion with Mike.
Well,
right?
No, we had a great show with Mike. He was his normal self. Very blunt, to the point, fun, energetic, entertaining. So please definitely
and
listen
really,
to that.
Really intelligent guy.
He is. He really is. He keeps you on your toes. But I wanna go down the road of sports a little bit.
All right.
You wrote on the board, our whiteboard.
Yes. The whiteboard will come up in the show.
But you, talking about Deshaun Watson. Deshaun Watson is a quarterback of the Houston Texans. He last year played for Clemson. He won a national title. He beat the vaunted Alabama Nick Saban, you know, Alabama squad.
The juggernaut that is Alabama. Right.
I mean, he's a 4-year guy. He has coached Dabo Sweeney. Dabo Sweeney. His coach said nothing but good things about him and said, listen, if you don't take this guy early in the draft, you are going to regret it. He is the real deal. And all Deshaun Watson has done since he was given the ball for the Houston Texans is throw touchdowns, win games, and be a superstar. And unfortunately, he, in practice.
Not a game.
Not a game. We're talking about practice, okay? He blew out his ACL, and he's going to miss the remainder of the season. Devastating injury, although it's not as bad as it once was.
Right, he'll come back.
Right, now, the timing, it sucks because it's a year recovery. In reality, it's a year recovery, and they'll operate on it in the next couple weeks. He'll start rehab, and when I say a year recovery, a lot of that is mental. And when you're an athlete and you depend on your legs or your elbow or your shoulder or whatever it is, and especially in football, you get hit almost every play. There's a certain level of comfort that you have to have with the situation that you're going to put your body in, to where you say, okay, I'm comfortable with getting hit again.
Right.
So I can play loose and free and feel that if I get hit, my knee is not going to go sideways. And it takes about a year from the time that you get injured, have surgery, go through rehab, start playing again, to where you're able to just kind of play fast and free and loose. And so, you know, Deshaun Watson was, this is week nine-ish. I mean, because of the bye weeks, there's a little ambiguity there, but we're right dead middle in the middle of the season. And so I think realistically, if the Texans are smart and saying, listen, this guy came out of college, lit the league on fire, they would hold him out for every bit of 12 months, which means he doesn't start next season. You know, which means we don't see Deshaun Watson until week 8 or 9 of
next year, right?
If they're smart. Now, my fear is that between his ego and their desire to win and their thirst and hunger for what they saw this year, that they're going to say, okay, we're going to let him decide, and they're going to push the medical staff to say he's ready to go, and they're going to bring him back too early. And we may see another injury early, and then where he's not fully healed, he doesn't have the strength. And that's kind of my biggest concern with all of this.
I just, you know, you're thinking a few steps ahead. I just feel bad for the kid because, honestly, I didn't like him coming out of college just because he played for Clemson, and I don't like Clemson.
Do you know his story?
I don't know much about it.
So let me throw this out here. Deshaun Watson, we mentioned, played at Clemson. But before him, many years before him, there's a player in the NFL, Ward Dunn. Ward Dunn played for the Tampa Florida Bay State, Buccaneers. Right? He played at Florida State. He played for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. He played for the Atlanta Falcons. He was a small running back, very dynamic, but he had a situation where he grew up and, he lost his mom. And him losing his mom, he just had a strong sense of service. And so when you make it to the NFL, one of the things that a lot of people don't know is that you're required to have either a charity that you found or a charity that you are a partner of or you donate substantially to on a yearly basis while you're a part of the league. And so either you found your own charity foundation or you find one that you get very heavily involved with. Oh, yeah. Ward Dunn started his own sort of foundation where, not sort of, he started his own foundation where he provided homes for very low-income families, people who were practically homeless. He built homes for them. And the crazy thing about all of this and where there's a nexus and where they come together is that Warwick Dunn built a home Deshaun Watson's family.
Wow.
There's a picture.
That sounds vaguely familiar, so maybe I saw that at some point. But
you saw it because I pointed it out to you about 2 months ago.
Okay, that's where I saw it.
Well, 3 months ago, actually. Okay. Like around the time.
No, it wasn't 3 months ago. Is that recent?
The beginning of the NFL season.
Okay, okay.
But it's neither here nor there. The point is, though, so Deshaun Watson grew up in a home that Warwick Dunn built for his family. And Warwick Dunn didn't build it and say, well, Deshaun, you're a really good player.
Right.
I mean, Deshaun Watson,
barely your
kid. He was 11 years old at the time.
Okay.
You know, Deshaun Watson was 11 years old when this happened. So Warwick Dunn had no idea that this kid was going to grow up and end up at Clemson, lead them to a national title, and then go into the NFL and be the
rookie. If he did, he would have steered him towards Florida State.
Exactly. He did. It goes really more to Warwick Dunn and what he did in showing, like, this is, these guys do a lot of good that people have no idea what they're doing, right? And shame on the NFL for not highlighting this more. ESPN and the NFL Network, they try. But, you know, there's a lot of people who are out there who will tell you, you know, oh, these NFL players are taking a knee, but what are they really doing to help? Nothing. Actually, these guys do a lot. You know, Warwick Dunn is just one story.
Look at what Deshaun Watson did this year, right?
Right.
There were three women who worked for the Houston Texans organization in, like, housekeeping, whose homes were wiped out by Hurricane Harvey, and he split his first game check three ways and gave it to them. Do you know that story?
Yeah. No. Okay. Absolutely.
Okay. There was a video of it.
You could find it on our Facebook page.
Oh. Okay.
Also because I put it there.
Okay.
Yeah, please ask me if I'm familiar with it,
Jim. Why is everything going to be a fight with you? But no, it was a really touching thing.
Feisty.
You are feisty today.
I'm a Janet Jackson fan.
It was really a beautiful thing. I mean, he was,
that's a great thing. And it's my point in bringing this up is, you know, you have the NFL protests and it's divisive.
Right. Yes, I think it's fair to say.
And yeah, my thing is that, listen, no matter what you think, these guys do a lot of good. I know it's they're paid a lot of money, right? And they're playing the game, right? And you have a hard job, whether it's a blue-collar job or a job where you got to get up and you got to drive 40 minutes to work and you hate your boss and it's repetitive and it's redundant and whatever, and you got a master's degree and whatever. But it is what it is. And these guys, they don't control what they get paid to a certain degree. The market controls what they get paid. The market controls what you get paid.
True.
And if you get past the money aspect and you look at it from a human aspect, there's a lot of guys in the NFL. There's more good guys than there are bad. And there's more good guys who do a lot of good than there are who do nothing. For the most part, a lot of these guys do a lot of good, because and the one good thing, and this it came from not Tagliabue, but the NFL commissioner before Tagliabue. I can't think of his name right now, but he's the one who mandated the charity.
Pete Rozelle.
I feel there was somebody between Rozelle
okay.
and Tagliabue. Maybe not. I
could be wrong about that, too.
But either way. But the point is that there's a lot of good that gets done. And I'm not even saying this to say, to kind of counter all the negativity with the flag protests, but it's just to say you got a large group of people here who are making a lot of money, but they are also doing a lot of good. Don't let that blind you. Right. Don't let that blind you. And what I mean by that is, like, use that as a reason for yourself to do what you can in your own space. Right. Like, these guys are making millions of dollars. They can literally sit on their ass and do nothing. But there's a lot of them who make a lot of money and who still feel compelled to do what they can, right?
I mean, they make a lot of money, and they also have, while they have incredibly demanding schedules for parts of the year, they have a lot of free time in parts of the year, and a lot of them choose to use that free time to do good things. And this is something that doesn't maybe get as much attention as it should.
Right. And I guess the other part of that, though, is that we don't all, like you and I, we don't have a lot of free time. Well, I don't.
You don't.
I don't.
I don't. But, I do, and then I don't. Right, the way I work.
You ebb and flow. But, I mean, I don't. But I still try to do things that have a positive impact on, you know, my community and people around me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do a lot of things. I mean, the March of Dimes thing you do every year, and there's multiple others. But, yeah.
It's not, well, yeah, there's things that I do. And just to have a positive impact. And we can all do them. And I think if more of us got involved with those sort of things and really got involved, and we said, every year I'm going to do this, right? Every year I'm going to do three things. I'm going to do three benefits. I'm going to do three fundraisers. I'm going to do these three things. They're going to take a lot of time. They're going to take a lot of effort. And I'm not going to get paid. But it's going to help this group of people. These kids, these veterans, these people with disabilities or whatever, then I think there wouldn't be so much anger. There wouldn't be so much frustration. I think one of the biggest issues with, you know, these NFL players taking a knee, I think a lot of it is people being frustrated just with their own situation, right? Right, they're just like, these guys make all this money and they're not doing anything. I'm not doing anything, but it's because I don't have the time to, because I have a job 9 to 5. And I've got three kids, and I drive a minivan, and all that other shit, right? And I think it's a lot of it is kind of like self-projecting on these guys. It's just like, well, if I had $1 million, then I would be able to do all these different things. And you have $1 million, and you're not doing them. So therefore, I'm going to project my anger and frustration on what I can't do on you, because you're not doing what I want you to do, and now you're doing this thing that I really don't like.
And I mean, last night in the wake of the attacks in New York, both teams avoided doing any anthem protests. They said they were going to avoid the controversy this week. You know, New York has had obviously an attack and a tragedy, and LeSean McCoy was someone that got zoomed in on, and he was right there standing with his teammates, and that's the right thing to do, because there's a time to say, all right now let's focus on the bigger picture. And we'll focus on the real issue that we're here to protest when the time is right again, which is probably next week, and people can choose to get upset about that if they want. But I was really glad to see both the Bills and the Jets stand for the anthem last night as a way of, not that I have objected to the protests in the past so much as it was a, let's not make that the focus of tonight.
Yeah, and I agreed. That was a smart move by them. I think... You know, my argument is that these protests have been kind of misdirected at best. Is it for Colin Kaepernick? Is it for what Colin Kaepernick was
doing? I think it's what he believes in, yeah.
And I think a lot of these different players have their own different reasons for why they're kneeling, in which I think in and of itself is part of the problem when you're going to do a league-wide sort of demonstration like this. And so... people criticize me and say, oh, you should be supporting this. And it's just like, I'm a bigger supporter of the conversation between the players and the league as to what they can do as an organization to impact all these different issues, right? Because I feel like there's 3 to 4 key issues here.
I think there's one main one. The one main one is... policing practices in minority communities. I think that's, at least to me, that's pretty clear.
Yeah, maybe. I don't think that's clear. Okay. That's Colin Kaepernick's clear big thing. But even with him, you know, the conversation...
It got political when Trump stepped in. There were lots of guys just basically
saying... Even before that, it got political. And even before that, Colin Kaepernick's thing, it was about oppression. It was about policing practices. It was about... just overall injustice and oppression of Black people, which is something worth looking into. But I think that there are more effective ways to impact changes to all of those things. you know, from the policing practices, having the NFL in every city, you know, in every major city that the NFL is in, and having that team go directly to the police department and say, hey, you're treating guys who look like us different. How can we get you to not do that anymore? Having that conversation, putting it in a public forum, in a town hall type setting, can go a yeah. long way. I think having NFL teams and NFL players and owners and coaches and general managers go to schools and say, hey, you guys are doing a really bad job of graduating students. What's going on here? What can we do to help? Do you need more access to scholarships? Do you need more access to field trips so these kids can see and experience college or different, you know, they can get outside of their bubble? Like, what do you need from us so that a ninth grader comes in to school thinking about higher education as opposed to what they're going to do to get by once they're done with this mandatory thing that they had to do called high school? I think there's just a lot of different things that can be done besides some of the camera photo op shit that gets posted out there as being effective. And this whole thing with taking a knee, all right, you had your say.
We've talked about this a bunch.
Right, and I just, to me, there's other things that can be done besides this that are more effective long-term that really impact the goals these guys are talking about than this whole thing with, I'm going to take a knee, I'm going to take a stand, put the camera on me on Monday Night Football, on Sunday Night Football, on, you know, I just, that's my opinion.
All right. Well, 3, 2, go.
Jim, one thing.
Yes, sir.
You know, I love Florida, right? Eventually, I would love to move there. Like, I just, the weather and... But Florida, they got issues down there.
They do.
They got issues. It's, I can't call it the Wild Wild West.
No, it's the wild, weird-ass... Florida's its own animal, period.
Right,
like,
period.
I mean, the Sklar Brothers have a podcast, and they used to do... Did it happen in Florida based on the crime? I mean, like, if it involved a samurai sword and a 40-year-old living at home, it happened in Florida. It happened in
Florida, right. So, today...
Yes.
We get a story, and...
I'm terrified where you're going with this. You always mock me for the bad segues. This is a weird segue, and I'm very frightened. Well,
there's no good segue for this.
Oh, no.
I get an alert that a woman got a DUI on a horse... In Florida, Polk County.
You know what? I just remember seeing that you put this on WhiskeyCongress.com.
Yeah, I did. I had to put it on WhiskeyCongress.com. It came out on Twitter and Facebook for our site. But a woman, and listen, it happened at like 1:46 in the afternoon. Like, so middle of the day, this woman is slammed on a horse in the middle of the road, a major road apparently in Polk County, which is pretty much dead center Florida.
Yeah.
And, you know, she gets arrested on suspicion of DUI. And
on a horse.
On a horse. Now listen, we
equestrian while intoxicated, EWI.
We drink our beer. We
drink our whiskey.
We drink our whiskey. But we strongly advocate against drinking and driving.
Yes, we do.
It's dangerous. It's irresponsible. It puts you at risk. It puts the other people on the road at risk. So don't do it. I have consumed a fair amount tonight, and I took an Uber here, and I will be taking an Uber home. That's how we roll.
That's how we do things, right?
And so, you know, this is not to make light of drinking and driving, but let me tell you... I have to say, if I had access to a horse, I may be prone. Before this, I may have been prone to make a bad decision, but now I know for sure that DUIs can include bicycles, golf carts, roller skates, skateboards, jet skis, boats, and horses.
I don't know a better way to end that End the segment. So let's.
So we're gonna end the segment. We're gonna end the show. We're gonna end it by saying, "Don't drink and drive.
Don't ride and drink. Don't drink and ride. And
ride rough.
Don't drink and bareback." And it's not also good advice, but
or definitely drink and bareback.
Okay. On that note, this is Whiskey Congress. We're gonna finish this episode up. We'll be posting right afterwards with our episode when we had Mike Wood Jr. call into us. It was a lot of fun talking to him. So we'll do these back to back. And don't drink and drive a horse in Polk County, Florida.
Right, or anywhere.
Or anywhere. Don't there's drink, nowhere that's a good idea.
Don't drink and ride your horse in any county, in any state.
All right, man. Good talking to you.
Yep.
Bye.